sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the water wells in the world drying up when we come back. You know, the Del Monte Company is ending its pineapple production in Hawaii. And this is another exporting of our jobs. It's another example of world trade. Sugar and pineapple, those two words used to be synonymous with Hawaii in a year where Hawaiians of Filipino descent are celebrating their 100th anniversary in the islands. One of the two cash crops which brought them to Hawaii, along with immigrants from China and Japan, is facing another longtime grower abandoning the islands for cheaper production elsewhere. Where once sugarcane and pineapple fields were strewn across most of the Hawaiian islands, now you'll find housing developments, resort hotels, and condominiums, and more often just barren fields. Del Monte is going to cease pineapple production in Hawaii permanently. Fresh Del Monte Produce Incorporated announced last week that after 90 years in Hawaii, they will plant their last crop of pineapple on Oahu this month and will cease all of their operations by 2008 when that crop is harvested. Citing the expense of growing pineapple in Hawaii when it can be produced much cheaper elsewhere in the world, Del Monte's decision will leave about 700 pineapple workers without a job. Del Monte also cites an inability to secure a long-term lease extension from landowner the Campbell Estate as a reason for their decision. However, this claim is disputed by Campbell Estate Vice President Bert Hatton, as reported by KITV, the Hawaiian Channel, in a story on February 1st, 2006. In that story, Hatton said that's surprising because in 2001, Campbell offered Del Monte a lease extension at its current rent structure, he said. Del Monte declined that offer, and Hatton also said that Campbell offered to sell the pineland to Del Monte in three separate proposals, but Del Monte declined all three offers. Del Monte's decision leaves only two companies which grow pineapple in Hawaii. That's Dole Food and Maui Pineapple Company. Now, the history of Hawaiian pineapple is this. The exact date of the first pineapples grown in Hawaii is a subject of historical debate. Some historians believe that it arrived on Spanish ships from the New World as early as 1527. It is known that Francisco de Paul Marin, a Spanish horticultural experimenter, who arrived in Hawaii in 1794 after being shanghaied from San Francisco. Marin became a friend and advisor to King Kamehameha I and is known to have experimented with raising pineapples in the early 1800s. Captain John Kidwell is most often credited with founding Hawaii's pineapple industry. He began crop development trials in 1885 when he planted pineapple in Manoa on the island of Oahu. It was, however, James Drummond Dole who is most credited with advancing the industry in Hawaii. In 1900, Dole purchased 61 acres in central Oahu and began experimenting with pineapple. In 1901, he incorporated the Hawaiian Pineapple Company and began commercial growing of the fruit. Dole is forever known as Hawaii's Pineapple King. As reported on the website of the Dole Plantation, Incorporated, in 1907, Dole established a cannery near the Honolulu Harbor, which was closed to the labor pool, shipping ports, and supplies. This cannery, at one time the world's largest cannery, remained in operation until 1991. Dole is also the one who is responsible for pineapple production on the island of Lanai, once known as the Pineapple Island. So there's another outsourcing of jobs, just 700, it's no big deal, but it's just another point that I make. God bless the world's free trade. Huh? Here's another quick one over here. The USA market growth is stifled by undersupply. This comes from the Organic Monitor. So if you're looking for some opportunity, you know, business, you know, is like, or opportunity, I like to say to my students, is like rain. It's everywhere. Here's an opportunity. American consumers cannot get enough organic foods, with producers unable to meet demand. And as a result, most sectors of the organic food industry are suffering undersupply, which has stunted, or has stunted, market growth. Shortage of organic products is making producers look outbound for raw materials. Increasing volume of organic fruit, vegetables, grains, seeds, beans, and herbs are being imported into the United States. And finished products are also imported to meet consumer demand for all things organic. The flood of imports is making the organic food trade gap to widen, and it's estimated that over $1.5 billion of organic products are imported into the United States every year, compared to about $150 million worth of American exports of organic fruits and vegetables. Scarcity of raw material is leading Stonyfield Farm, the dominant producer of organic yogurt, to look at sourcing organic milk powder from New Zealand. The company is to send inspectors to New Zealand to ensure the organic milk meets American standards. The low number of organic livestock producers in the United States has been responsible for the organic meat industry to experience shortages for a number of years, and American producers have resorted to imported organic beef from Australia and Latin America. Supply shortages are taking its toll on the market. Nearly all market sectors would grow at much higher rates if sufficient supply was available. For instance, lack of organic milk has caused many retailers to have empty shelves throughout the year. The organic juice market appears to have become the major casualty. However, with news that a leading organic juice producer is to exit the market because of a shortage of raw material. The organic food company cannot find enough orange juice to meet its growing production needs and has decided to withdraw from the market altogether and focus on other product categories. The Florida hurricanes depleted orange juice stocks, and imports are prohibitively expensive. Organic Monitor predicts the refrigerated organic juice segment could contract by up to 20% in 2006 because of the company's market withdrawal. Although competitors are likely to increase market share, few have the distribution and marketing resources to replace its strong presence. With American demand for organic foods expected to strengthen in coming years, supply shortages are likely to continue. And unless more American farmers consider converting to organic practices, exporters are likely to capitalize on this lucrative market. So here again is a market for Chinese and Japanese and all kinds of competitors around the world. It's not because we can't produce it or don't need to produce it here in the United States. It's that we don't have enough people that are willing to work in this country or who want to produce. All right, last time we were talking about the groundwater drawdown of the Oglala Aquifer here in the United States. I pointed out to you that the groundwater is, let's see if I can find my paper here, that the groundwater is being drawn out at a rate far in excess of groundwater recharging. So it's not that it isn't that all of the aquifers do not recharge from rainwater and surface runoff. It's that many do not. And there's a little piece of the story over here in Libya. They've got 35,000 cubic kilometers of water. That's a bunch, 35,000 cubic kilometers. I figured that the Oglala Aquifer here contains around, what hell did I figure here, 250 billion acre feet of water. The average depth of it is about 200 feet, and it occupies 174,000 square miles, or 176,000. It's in six states through the Midwest. It's a big piece of real estate with a lot of water in it, and we've been drawing a lot of water out of it for a long time. And the ultimate end of it is that we're going to completely mine it. And I don't see any reason to believe that anybody is going to get control of the problem before it's too late. It's kind of like having a bank account, and somebody leaves you a large amount of money. Most people don't know how to manage or how to handle money. And if you give them $1 million, it's a race to see how fast can I squander it? How fast can I spend it? How fast can I get rid of it? I don't ever remember anybody that's won a lottery or won a large court judgment that's ever hung on to the money for a lifetime or passed it on to future generations. I've got a brother-in-law, and he had a farm down here, and he sold the farm, and he and his wife are in the process, they're retired now, in the process of spending the money on themselves as rapidly as possible. They want to make sure that they have absolutely nothing left for the children. They don't want to leave any estate at all. That's the thinking, by the way, of most Americans. How can we consume this? We're not going to leave this for our children or our children's children. We're not going to leave the water in the aquifer for our children or our children's children. We are going to consume it all right now. And I have to ask the question, why? Why do you want to destroy it all? It's kind of like a forest. When you get to the forest, it's prime. It's virgin forest. And there's lots of lumber. There's lots of wood there. And so we went into the forest and we destroyed it. Why not harvest it, and then why not replant it, and why not maintain it so that it is a forest that produces lumber forever, for everybody, future generations forever? It's an old concept that comes from the Bible called dressing and keeping the garden. Why not, it's a wild new concept, why not manage the forest, manage the aquifer, manage the farm, manage the land, manage the resource, so that you have sustainable production forever. I know that in the spring I have more grass than my cows can eat. And of course, a lot of people, when they have a lot of grass, they want to put on more cattle to eat that grass up. I'm a little different. Let the grass grow. Whatever it is that the cows don't eat will rot, go back into the soil, and build the organic material in the soil. Every time I bring in a bale of hay, and my cows don't eat it all, they scatter some of it on the ground. That's organic material. I keep moving the hay rings so that they scatter it in different places. In fact, I put the hay rings on barren little pieces of ground, poor pieces of ground that don't produce well. And then you find that you get more organic material and it produces better. You can actually build soil. You can actually create forests. Along the Mediterranean coast, they are planting more and more forest, more and more trees, which attracts more and more moisture through transpiration into the atmosphere, which produces more and more rainfall, which falls further and further into the Sahara Desert, which creates more vegetation, which creates more life, which creates more good ground, which you know, produces. Now, if you cut down your trees, like they do in Chad and the Sahel, then you eliminate trees that put moisture into the air. It's a process. It's a natural process. Transpiration is what that word is called in a live, mature oak tree here where I live. Takes 1,800 gallons of water a year out of the ground and evaporates it into the atmosphere through its leaves. 1,800 gallons a year. And that's why here in the eastern United States, where the land is covered by forests, you have greater rainfall. And where you cut the forest down, you have less and less rainfall. In the Amazon jungle in 1957, the annual average rainfall was 120 inches a year. Today, it's 90 inches a year. It's still a rainforest, but they're cutting 4,000 square miles a year and converting it to agricultural land. Well, between 1960 and 2005, which is about 45 or 50 years, we're into it about 50 years, we have reduced the rainfall in the Amazon basin by 30 inches a year. Do you think that we could reduce it by another 30 inches over the next 50 years? I mean, if we get after it, and then we get more people with more chainsaws cutting down more trees, we could probably reduce the Amazon basin to a desert in 100 or 200 years, you know, if we could really get after it. But is creating deserts really what we want to do? In China today, desertification is taking about 1,000 square miles per year. 1,000 square miles a year. A state or a piece of real estate about the size of Rhode Island every year. Do you think that's a good practice? Do you think that that is something that's going to advance the world or advance agriculture or advance any particular interest in the world, making bigger and bigger deserts? In the Sahara Desert, it grows at 100 square miles a year. The Chinese can produce desert at the rate of 10 times more than the Africans can. But do you think that that's a good plan? That's why I brought up the subject of the depletion of the aquifers here. It isn't that I'm going to stop it or that I'm even going to slow it down. I'm not here to start some movement now to get you to join some organization so that we can write letters to our senators and representatives. The problem is far beyond any government in the world being able to solve. The process is well along toward disaster. And in fact, that disaster is spoken of in Bible prophecy. It's in several chapters in the scripture. I've mentioned this before. And in fact, in Matthew 24, the Messiah said that unless he comes to take over control of the world, no flesh would be left alive on the planet at an indefinite time in the future. So I brought up to your attention here that we've got about five or six of these problems that threaten the extinction of mankind from off the planet, of which this water depletion in the groundwater over here is one of the crucibles by which we're accomplishing that goal. So I'm fully persuaded that we're on that track and that we're going to stay on that track. And about 90% of the people in the world drawing breath today are not going to be drawing breath when the Messiah sets foot back on planet Earth. So when the second coming occurs, there's going to be a great dying off, spoken of in Revelation chapter 6. In biblical terms, he says 1/4 of mankind is going to be destroyed by this thing of disease by itself. If you take those four horsemen of the apocalypse, the four horsemen of the Revelation, if you took 25%, then you took 25% of what's left, and 25% of what's left, and then 25% of what's left, and then you add on to that the three woes and the great tribulation, I think that you can get it down to about 10%. That's what Isaiah 13 tells us. And by the way, that's what the New World Order people at the Club of Rome tell us is their goal, and that's to reduce the Earth's population by about 90%. And they're well on their way to accomplishing that goal. Meanwhile, back on the farm, you and I have the problem of do we want to be one of the victims or do we want to be one of the survivors? It's a choice that you got to make. Now, I mentioned to you last time when we finished that the groundwater rush was like a gold rush. It was a great uncontrolled bonanza, this thing of drilling wells and putting in center pivots. The International Water Management Institute has estimated that the total global withdrawal of groundwater is now up to 1,000 cubic kilometers a year. I pointed out to you that's about 600 cubic miles of water a year. But it is quite unsustainable. And this greater global rush to exploit available groundwater resources in our time is one of extraction of a limited natural resource. Groundwater has been, and in many areas still continues to be, the best and only readily available source of clean drinking water. And this is because the groundwater may be just directly below the place of use for agriculture, cities, factories, and mines. And in most cases, the groundwater is available at no cost except for the cost of the well and the pump. Now, the groundwater in these underground reservoirs has accumulated in geologic time, and the resource can be considered as a great reservoir of water that has been captured in open joints and fissures in the rock and in pores in porous rocks in the natural state prior to intervention to exploit the resource. The underground reservoir was filled to the brim and overflowed naturally into springs and into lakes and streams. Prior to 1950, most of the world's groundwater basins were in a condition close to a state where the rate of use of the groundwater was compatible with sustainability of the resource. After over half a century of massive exploitation, however, far greater than any possible rate of recovery, most of this groundwater, the groundwater basins of the world, are now close to the limits of the resource. The consequences are now evident in many countries. In essence, the world has been exploiting the reserve bank of groundwater at a rate far greater than the rate of natural replacement, and the water bank is becoming insolvent. This excess use of water is a deficit that can never be repaid in our lifetimes. The deficit in the groundwater bank is also being matched by a deficit in the food that it provided. Thus, the present prosperity that we experience today in much of the world is based upon borrowing from the bank of water held in these aquifers, which is also, in essence, the borrowing of food from the food bank, neither of which can be repaid. And as a consequence, there has been an artificial stimulus of food production in many countries, where groundwater enabled food production to be raised well above sustainable levels. Now, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization even suggested that the rapid exploitation of groundwater has saved the world from a food crisis. But if countries have been borrowing water on credit and effectively borrowing food on credit, then it means that the world is facing the prospect of an even more serious food crisis. And this prospect is already highly evident in some countries as they try to rapidly expand food production from resources of surface waters, especially in China and in India. And I might point out here, boys and girls, that China and India have approximately, not quite, but approximately, one-third of the world's population. Just those two countries. One-third of the world's population. Now, you know, those countries are mining their water resources at an alarming rate, and have been for 50 years. I didn't know that. I didn't know how fast these aquifers were being drawn down. I'd heard and read some vague references that here in America, we were drawing water out of the Oglala Aquifer faster than it was being recharged. And then my well went dry, and then I got real excited about it and said, gee, I ought to look into this. Now I find out that my own reservoir right here in the Ozarks region is also being depleted. Ah, gets a little closer to home. Now, not everybody's aquifer is being depleted. And some of them are being depleted at a lesser rate. Ours won't go dry here, at least not until the second coming, or at least not in my lifetime. But I need to make preparations here for my daughter and my son. I've got to advise them and tell them, hey, listen, we got a problem here, boys and girls, and we need to solve it. I'm not going to be here to suffer the problem with you or to bail your chestnuts out of the fire when it gets here. I had to solve the problem for myself when our well went dry. I had to drill a deeper well. But this well is also going to go dry in about 30 years, just based upon the history, just based upon the drawdown, just based upon the numbers that come in here. Unless something pretty dramatic occurs, you know, we could start getting greater recharging of the aquifer or some other miracle may occur, but I'm not counting on it. And I think I need to prepare for it. And I know how to do that, and I'm going to do that. We need to conserve our water, and we need to collect more water on the surface. We need to build more dams over here on our depressions and build more ponds and rely more upon the surface water. I'll keep the well as a reserve, but instead of drawing down that bank account, I think I'll see if I can't stabilize my own bank account. I think everybody in the world would be better advised to do that, but I don't think they're going to. And that means that a crisis then in food production is inevitable. Well, unless something pretty dramatic comes along, like the people of the world start having fewer and fewer children so that we can stabilize population and then slowly reduce it. Because the world today is unsustainable at 6 billion. Boys and girls, if there were no new births, of which there are about 100 million a year, we're increasing our population at the rate of 100 million a year, or about a billion every decade. And remember, that grows geometrically. So that billion added to the 6 billion that's here, then it adds geometrically. So, as time progresses, it won't be 100 million a year, it'll be 110 million a year, and then 120 million, and then pretty soon 130 million a year, and then 200 million a year, and then the world's population will be adding a billion every 5 years instead of a billion every 10. And even if you could stabilize population today at 6 billion people, the consumption of raw materials on the planet will not sustain those 6 billion people or a population of 6 billion indefinitely into the future. There isn't enough natural resources on the planet. You can support them for a while. It's just like in the spring, you know, I can put 100 cows out there on the North 40. But that North 40 will not sustain 100 cows for 3 months or 6 months or 9 months or 12 months. They'll starve to death. And the world's population is in that predicament right now. Yeah, there's plenty out there today. But, you know, that'd be like me sticking 100 cows up there right now, and there's enough feed up there for 100 cows today. And then I could add 10 cows every week for the next 4 to 6 weeks and still have plenty of feed. But at some point in time, the feed is going to collapse, because when the grass stops growing, which it does around the 1st of July, when the grass stops growing, those cows will eat everything that's up there right down to the ground. And then what are you going to do in July, August, and September? So you've got to make preparations for that in advance. If there's nothing else in life to learn from farming, it's that you have to manage your resources. I guess people that live in cities, people that go to colleges and universities, don't have to do that. They can just use what's available and have another party. And we don't have to think about the future or how you're going to feed 12 billion people over the next 25 or 30 years. You're not going to feed them off of the Oglala aquifer, I'll tell you that. Because there's only a 20-year supply left at today's rate of consumption, and we're drilling new wells every day, every day. So not only are we down to 20 years, we're using it faster. It isn't going to last 20 years. And there's more and more people. And as we build the infrastructure on top of this aquifer, which we can do because the water is there today, and it's going to be there for the next 5 years to the next 10 years. But when you've pumped the last gallon out, it's dry. What are you going to grow your crops with then? Because you don't have rain in due season. And that's because you don't practice the law of God, and He's not going to give you rain in due season. And you could give the finger to God over the past 50 years. You didn't need rain in due season because you had the water in the water bank called the aquifer that you could irrigate from, and that's what we've done for the last 50 or 60 years. Boys and girls, that isn't going to be sustainable past the next 10 or 15 years. Then what are you going to do? And then on top of that, the grain that we're growing here in America from this irrigated water. See, we're drawing water out of our water bank to grow grain to sell to the Chinese. And the Chinese are happy to buy the grain because by doing that, they save 1,000 tons of water a year. They don't have to use out of their water bank, out of their aquifer, which, by the way, they're drawing down also. Hang on, I got to give you a reminder here. If I can find my reminder paper. Maybe if I don't find the reminder paper, I don't need to give it to you. Here it is. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, history, health, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications so endorsed or recommended are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily entirely endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. We're talking about the drawing down of the groundwater in our aquifers around the world. Yeah, I got to give you a little reminder here, a piece of information also. I got a letter the other day from a fellow named Singh, S-I-N-G-H. I assume he's an Indian fellow. Anyway, he was a little miffed, and he said if his name wasn't Singh, if it was Jones or Smith, would he get better service in ordering our free general law CD package? I think that is a backhanded request or comment on a discriminatory process. And I want to assure Mr. Singh that we do not discriminate against people because of their religion or ethnic origin or skin color or anything of that nature. And so the answer, Mr. Singh, is that in the event that your name was Jones or Smith or Davis, you would not get that general law CD package any sooner or any later. We give the same slipshod, sloppy, we don't give a damn service to everybody, irrespective of race, color, or creed. And that's because we're old folks here. You know, we're old and full of years. And we offer it free of charge, and we're going to make sure that you get yours in due time. But I want to point out that as requests come in, that old people that we are, we work as hard as we can, and we fill those requests, but that doesn't mean that we work like Sears or Walmart and that we can get it out in the next day's mail. It may take us a week or two, or three or four, or five or six, or whatever it's going to take us to get it together and get it out, and we're going to do that for you, Mr. Singh, so be patient, please. All right, with that out of the way, so that you don't think that we're taking advantage of you, there's one other solution to the problem. I always recommend to people, if you don't like the service that you get from a supplier, change suppliers. If the Gordon Law School does not satisfy your needs, desires, wants, etc., go to the Harvard Law School or the Yale Law School or the Princeton Law School or some other law school and just say to hell with the Gordon Law School because they offer bad service. And that's just the way business works, and we apologize if we're not as fast as we ought to be, but, you know, when you get to be old, you get to be crotchety. All right, talking about China's water crisis. China is heavily dependent on groundwater. Most of the flat areas of China overlay groundwater basins, and the groundwater is being extracted for water supply for cities, industries, and agriculture. The northern agricultural areas of China are virtually drying out. The major rivers have ceased to flow in the dry season. The water table under the North China Plain, which produces half of China's wheat and a third of their corn, is falling at an alarming rate. Under Hebei Province, in the heart of North China, the North China Plain, the water level in the deep aquifer is falling at the rate of 3 meters a year. 3 meters a year. Now, there's 3 feet in a meter, 39 inches. That's 9 feet a year it's dropping. So they're mining that aquifer at the rate of 9 feet a year. I don't know how many feet are in it. Here in the United States, the Oglala Aquifer averages 192 feet of water over the entire thing. It ranges from as low as 1 foot to as much as 400 feet thick. I mean, there's places where there's 400 feet of water. I mean, you could drill a well down, you know, like I do here in where my water is, 500 feet deep. There are some places in the Oglala Aquifer that are 500 feet deep, solid water. But there are places where it's only 1 foot deep. Same reservoir, same water. And the thing ranges over several states. I mean, it's a big piece of real estate. It's a lot of water. And the Chinese have the same thing where they're at. They've got an aquifer there, but it's going down at the rate of 9 feet a year. Now, boys and girls, at some point in time, let's just try that out. Let's suppose that we've got 400 feet. I think it was 460 feet some places, but let's just plug in 500 feet. Now, let's just divide that by nine. That's 55 years. If the Chinese continue to draw that aquifer down at the rate of 9 feet a year, and assuming that it's as big as, which it isn't, and as deep as, which it isn't, the Oglala, in 55 years it's going to be dry. Now, what do you think those Chinese are going to do when they lose one-third of their grain production in their country? Do you think they might have to go to war to take it away from somebody else? Well, assuming that somebody else won't sell it to them. Now, Americans aren't going to be able to sell it to them if our aquifer goes dry in the next 20 years, and at the rate we're drying it down, it's 80% used up now. We got 20% left. It'll last 20 years at today's rate. But we're going to use it at a higher rate next year and the year after and the year after that. It grows geometrically. I'm just pointing it out to you so that you can get ready for it. Over the next 20 years, you people today that are 20, 30, 40 years old, you're going to face this in your lifetime. I think probably I do too. I'm 67. If I live to be 87 years old, it's going to affect me just before I die at age 87. And if I live to be 97, I mean, hell, I might be like Bob Hope and live to be 100. You know, you got to face reality. And I've got children, and you've got children, and all of us here are living on the same planet. And for us to say that, well, that's a problem for the Chinese. Oh, no. Boys and girls, wake up, smell the coffee. That's a problem for you in Poughkeepsie or Chicago or Miami or Los Angeles or Topeka, Kansas. It's a problem for all of us. And see, when those Chinese are starving to death, they're going to come and get food. And they got nuclear weapons, and if they think they can take it away from us, they will. And if they think they can take it away from the Iranians or anybody else that's around their neighborhood, they'll do that too. I mean, that's just the way life is. It's always been that way. I don't expect it to change. This decline, the decline of the water table has led to wells drying up and to deeper wells being drilled. The consequent increase in pumping costs has forced some farmers off the land, while the demand for groundwater for cities and industries has continued to grow in Beijing. The new wells for the city water supply now have to reach 1,000 meters to tap fresh water. 1,000 meters. Boys and girls, let's try that one. 1,000. I'll plug that into my famous Sharp EL1197G3 calculator. Times 39 divided by 12 equals 3,250 feet. Can you believe that? Now listen, boys and girls, I had to drill a 500-foot well. In Beijing, China, they have to drill 3,250 feet. Now, they got several million people that live in that city. And they're using up the groundwater to supply those people in that city, to supply their industries, to supply their agriculture in the neighborhood. And that isn't going to go on forever. Because the next time it'll be down to 6,500 feet. And that's assuming that there's any water down there at 6,500 feet. There is water at 3,250, and that's where they're drilling to get it. Boys and girls, that's like oil wells. This water is an exhaustible resource that's being used up worldwide. The story gets worse as we progress along. The pumping of groundwater in the North China Plain has resulted in the entire area subsiding, with many funnels and sinks appearing on the ground surface. Cities are reporting substantial subsidence, complicated by the consolidation of the ground under the new high-rise buildings. Shanghai started pumping groundwater for the city water supply in 1860. The old city of Shanghai sank 2 meters, that's 6 feet, in the period 1921 to 1965. From 1920 to 1965, 2 meters. Subsistence is continuing, and the authorities are now trying to correct it by injecting water into the aquifer. Under Shanghai, they're now injecting water to see if they can stabilize the subsiding of the city. Such ground subsidence in densely populated cities has caused great economic losses. as well as presenting a hazard to buildings and people. It's reported that Shanghai has suffered economic losses estimated at $35 billion in the past 40 years due to destructive flooding and tidal effects caused by subsidence, mostly caused by groundwater extraction. Hey, listen, there's a little problem. You know, as a contractor, that water runs downhill, your drainage water runs downhill. As your city subsides, it sinks into the ground in various areas. You've got to redo your sewer and your drainage water. That is the city water draining into the gutters. Just think of the problem that's coming up here. Now, that's in your urban areas. But your big Achilles heel, boys and girls, is that we have relied upon irrigation water to produce our food. And now we have grown to 6 billion people, and there is a finite period of time. More than likely less than 20 years. So when I talk about the second coming, the Messiah made this observation in Matthew 24. He said, you know, you can look up at the sky and you can read the clouds, and you can tell that it's going to rain tomorrow. And he said, you should be able to read the signs of the times. That's not an Advent publication. That was a prediction by Jesus of Nazareth when he said, you know, you people ought to be able to read the signs of the times. And he said, there's coming a point in time when no life would be left alive on planet Earth. Now, I think he's primarily referring to nuclear bomb war. And in 1957, a fellow by the name of Edward Teller, he's called the father of the hydrogen bomb. I mean, that's like being called the father of bubonic plague or the father of AIDS, you know. But he's the father, he's the creator of the hydrogen bomb. And in 1957, he wrote an article that I read in the San Francisco Examiner concerning the destructive power of a 20-megaton bomb that he said, if it were dropped on Treasure Island, which is out in the middle of San Francisco Bay between Oakland and San Francisco, he said it would dig a hole 600 feet in diameter. No, excuse me. It would dig a hole a half a mile in diameter, 600 feet deep. 600 feet deep, half a mile in diameter. And that it would kill 3 million people. It would kill everybody from the high ground in San Francisco to the high ground in the Berkeley Hills, as far south as San Jose, and as far north as Napa, in that basin, 3 million people. That's just one 20-megaton bomb. Now, they went on a little bit further, and they said that by 1960, the United States had the nuclear capacity to annihilate all life from off the planet. 1960, this is just 3 years later, that the United States of America had the nuclear capacity to annihilate all life from off the planet by 1960. That was pretty awe-inspiring back in the 1960s. By 1970, the United States and Russia combined had enough nuclear capacity to annihilate all life from off the planet 43 times over, just 10 years later. You know, I'm just an old country boy, but it seemed like to me that just annihilating all life from off the planet one time is plenty, isn't it? Why do you need enough nuclear capacity to annihilate all life from off the planet 43 times over? I mean, that's like stockpiling enough gasoline to burn your house down 43 times over. Seems like to me that 5 gallons ought to do the job. What's the purpose? Where are you going with this? Now, the people that are running the world today, boys and girls, all went to college and they've all got degrees after their names, and they're real smart people and they get straight A's. But I don't really think that these people have very much intelligence. Creating a problem like nuclear weapons does not strike me as being very intelligent. No. I'm just an old country boy, and I'll leave it for your decision. You know, you can figure it out for yourself. So when the Messiah comes along and says, you know, boys and girls, you're going to kind of need me because I'm going to come save you from yourselves. Now I take a look at this groundwater problem over here and I say, wait a minute, boys and girls, we haven't been thinking very far ahead, sucking all this water out of the ground. Now, in my case, it's just plain ignorance. I went to public school and they told me that these aquifers are being recharged by the rainwater. I thought that they were self-sustaining. I thought that we had aquifers over here that were being recharged. I thought somebody had his head on straight and was trying to control this problem. You know, typically, if you've got a problem out here on the range or a problem on the farm or you're some kind of a problem, you know, you go out and solve it. If my cows are getting out, I go down and fix the fence. I don't know if there's anybody out there fixing the fence. I just thought I'd share that with you. Now, in the Pudong new area of Shanghai, there are a large number of new skyscrapers. Settlement of the new urban area is being recorded about their settlement. That doesn't mean that they're settling in. It means that the land is settling. The land is sinking at 3 centimeters a year. And the foundation of the tallest building at 420 meters high sank by 6.3 centimeters in 2002. Most of that settlement is probably due to the great weight of the building, but extraction of groundwater would have contributed to it. And it may be unfair of me to mention that during construction of the tower in Pisa, Italy, in 1173 AD, it began to tilt in 1178, 5 years later, due to the extraction of groundwater nearby. Construction continued intermittently in the tilted position until 1350. It became famous as the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and I'm pleased to note that the buildings in Shanghai appear to be subsiding without tilting. Now, the urgency of the need to control the use of groundwater and to provide other sources of water and food has been recognized by the Chinese government. They are planning to build several new water projects, including 2 very large projects, one in China and one in Southeast Asia, to provide a food bowl for China. Now, in November of 2002, the Chinese government authorized the construction of a hugely ambitious water diversion plan to take water from the Yangtze River system to the Yellow River. The aim of the project is to divert water from the south of the country, where the rivers flow from the Tibetan Plateau, to the areas of water shortage in the North China Plain, and to Beijing and other industrial cities in the north. There are 3 separate diversion systems, and construction of the first diversion system began in 2002 and is estimated to cost $19 billion, and it's going to divert 13 billion cubic meters per year to North China. And there are 2 more similar diversions in the total project. Now, the total population of China is 1.3 billion, and it's still growing at 0.8% a year. That means an increasing demand for food. Even with the proposed water projects in China, there will still be a need to import food. So even with these massive water projects, they will not be able to solve the food problem. Now, one prospective source of food for export to China is called the Mekong Basin in Southeast Asia. The basin begins where the Mekong River leaves the mountains at the Thailand border and comprises the floodplain of the Mekong River and parts of Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And they go on to tell a little story here about how they had planned to build this clear back before the Vietnam War, and then the Vietnam War stopped it. And now the Chinese, who are now in need of more food, are proposing that they come in and finance the whole project. And it's going to be a massive project. And they want to finance the whole thing. What do you think is going to happen if Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and Thailand say nix to that, and we're not going to buy into the program, and we're not going to make a food bowl for China, and we're just going to keep it for ourselves? Do you think that the Chinese, when their population grows from 1 billion to 2 billion, are going to listen to a few million Vietnamese or Cambodians? Or do you think they'll just go down there and take it away from them? You know, that's been the history of mankind. Now, in the old days, a guy by the name of Malthus came up with a theory back around 1750. He said the world is going to populate itself into oblivion. Now, when jackrabbits or coyotes or cattle or any other species of animal overpopulates a region beyond their carrying capacity, we call it an agriculture carrying capacity, they die off. A disease comes in, kills off a bunch of them. Doesn't kill them all. There's always a few survivors. But it kills most, or it kills a bunch of them. So I just thought I'd point that out to you, that mankind is on that threshold. And you and I have to take evasive action. That is, if you want to be one of the survivors. You know, so just tuck it away in your heart that maybe you need to be a survivor rather than a victim. So I'm going to put my arrow right here, so we can take this up again next time. And let me give you another reminder that when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, that tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our population. They had a top tax rate of only 7%. Now, today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of this tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. Did you know that? 60%. And by the time Franklin Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. And in 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th. To earn enough to satisfy the tax man at every level this year. The average American family is going to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay your federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output and they were considered slaves. Now, what do you think that makes us? This income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. And this income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth. So that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and Status is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're about out of time, so let me remind you that the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. And the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening and good night, friends.